All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at a Supreme Court case that, well, it really gets at this question of when police questioning goes too far, you know, and violates someone's rights, especially when that person is, well, maybe not in the best position to defend themselves.
Yeah, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's Columbia v. Connecticut back in 1961. And it, well, it's still shaping how we think about confessions that might not be, you know, totally legit.
Absolutely. It's a landmark case, no doubt. And it forces us to really think about, like, the power dynamics, right, when you've got police interrogating someone.
For sure.
And the facts of this case, Colombe, they're really telling.
Yeah, to really understand what's going on here, you got to know about Arthur Colombe himself, right?
Right.
So the guy was 33 years old, but get this, he couldn't read.
Wow.
And his IQ was only 64. So, I mean, think about that. That's like, mentally, he was around 9 years old.
That's significant.
Yeah. I mean, you can see how someone like that would be, well, super vulnerable, right, when you're talking to the police.
Yeah, definitely. It makes you think about, like, where's the line, you know? How do we figure out when questioning someone like that is okay and when it crosses over into, like, something that's not right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what this whole case boils down to, right? Like, what's the core principle here?
It's about protecting people, right, who might not totally get their rights, or maybe they can't really, like, resist the pressure of a police interrogation.
Yeah, they get overwhelmed.
Exactly.
So let's walk through what happened here.
Okay.
Colombe, he's picked up by the police on February 23, 1957.
All right.
Now, they suspected him and a friend of his in a bunch of robberies and murders. And this included, like, a really bad one, a double homicide.
Oh, wow.
And the thing that stands out right away is how long they held him, right? Over 4 days.
4 days.
4 days. And during that whole time, they didn't formally charge him with anything. He didn't have a lawyer. They didn't even tell him about, you know, his basic rights.
So no arraignment or anything?
Nope, none of that. And that's, well, that brings us back to our question, right? Like, what's the risk of holding someone like Coulomb, you know, someone who's, well, not all there for that long without any of those protections?
I mean, holding anyone for that long without an arraignment it's a big red flag.
Right.
Arraignment's important. It's where they bring the accused in front of a judge, tell them what they're being charged with, and let them know about their rights.
Yeah, yeah, the whole due process thing.
Exactly, due process. The government's got to be fair, act according to the law. And, you know, this was before Miranda. So back then, the court was really looking at whether what Connecticut did was fundamentally unfair. So holding someone for 4 days without arraignment, it kind of makes you think, like, maybe the point wasn't to charge him right away. Maybe they had something else in mind.
Right, right. And the way they questioned him during those 4 days, well, it was pretty messed up.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they were grilling him constantly, but they kept coming back, questioning him on and off. But here's the really bad part. They brought his wife into it.
What?
Yeah, they got her to try and convince him to confess.
That's messed up.
It gets worse. They even, like, staged a fake court hearing for him on some minor charge. Just to, you know.
To intimidate him.
Yeah, exactly.
So manipulative. Was there, like, any legal reason they gave for doing that? Or was it just, you know, psychological pressure?
It seems like it was all about, you know, messing with his head, keeping him off balance.
Yeah.
Using his wife like that. I mean, that's taking advantage of someone's emotions, right? It can really mess with someone's ability to, like, think straight and make a clear decision.
Totally. And that fake court thing, it's like they were trying to control him outside of, like, the normal legal process.
And here's the kicker. Colombe actually asked for a lawyer.
He did.
He straight up asked for legal counsel. But they ignored him.
Oh, come on.
I mean, the guy clearly needed help, especially with, you know, his mental limitations. Yeah. But nope, no lawyer for him.
I mean, isn't that, like, a basic right?
Yeah, but remember, this is before Miranda. So denying him a lawyer, especially someone like Colombe, how does that play into this idea of coercion, of forcing a confession?
Well, a lawyer's there to, like, protect the suspect.
Right.
They make sure they understand their rights and that they're making choices, you know, with all the information. Someone like Colombe, with his, well, his limitations, having a lawyer there would have been so important.
Huge. So under all this pressure, after days of this, Colombe finally breaks down and confesses. Five times, orally.
Jeez.
And then they get him to sign three written statements. And at his trial, those confessions, they were the main evidence, even though his lawyer argued they were forced out of him.
Of course they were.
And he's convicted of murder. So this brings us to the big legal question, right?
Right.
Were those confessions actually voluntary? Or did they violate Colomy's 14th Amendment to due process rights? And like we said, this is pre-Miranda, so it all comes down to whether his will was overborne. Mm-hmm. You know, was he strong enough to resist the pressure?
Exactly. Was it really his choice, or did they basically force it out of him? That's what the court had to decide.
And to figure that out, they used this thing called the totality of circumstances test.
Yeah.
Which, okay, let's break it down and make it simple.
Right.
Basically, they looked at everything, the whole picture surrounding the confession, not just one thing.
Right.
So what were they looking at? What kind of factors mattered in this test?
Okay, so they looked at how long he was held, the conditions, what the police actually did, like using his wife and that whole fake court thing. And crucially, they looked at who Colombe was, right? His low IQ, not being able to read, all that made him way more susceptible to, well, to being coerced.
Right.
And they looked at any outside pressures on him.
So they took everything into account, looked at the whole situation.
The totality of circumstances.
And what did the Supreme Court decide? What was their final ruling in the opinion written by Justice Frankfurter?
Okay, so Justice Frankfurter, he's writing for the majority, and he said, yep, Colomy's confession, it was coerced. They found that the whole thing, the isolation, not letting him have a lawyer, using his disability against him, his wife, the delayed arraignment, it all added up to a situation where, yeah, his will was overborne.
They basically broke him down.
Yeah, there's this really powerful line in the opinion. The line is crossed when compulsion propels the confession. It really highlights how the confession has to be the suspect's choice, not something forced on them.
Powerful stuff.
It is. And Frankfurter really emphasized this idea of fundamental fairness. He said what the police did, especially with Colomy's vulnerabilities, it just wasn't fair. It didn't meet the standard of fairness required by the Due Process Clause.
Interesting. Now, were there other opinions on this? What did the other justices have to say?
Right. As always, there were concurring and dissenting opinions. Justice Brennan, he agreed with the majority, but went even further. He said all of Colomy's confessions were tainted, like poisoned by the coercive environment. Justice Douglas, he also concurred, but he focused on the denial of counsel, saying it violated Colomy's Sixth Amendment rights, even though this was before, you know, that right was totally solidified in police interrogations.
Right, right.
It's interesting because it kind of foreshadows Miranda.
Foreshadowing, yeah. So what about the dissent? What did those justices argue?
Justice Harlan, he wrote the dissent, and he basically said, look, the record doesn't actually prove coercion for sure. He thought maybe Colum confessed to try and, you know, make his situation a little better.
Interesting.
Yeah, but the majority really pushed back on that, saying, look, with Colum's mental state, he couldn't have made that kind of calculated decision under all that pressure.
Right.
His limitations, they prevented him from making a deliberate choice. And this really shows how the court looks at cases with vulnerable people. They really scrutinize them.
They give them extra attention.
Yeah, because what might seem like a strategic choice for someone, you know, with normal mental abilities, it might not be that at all for someone like Colomé. It could be a sign of them just being, well, totally overwhelmed.
Yeah, I see that. So stepping back a bit, what makes this case, Colomby v. Connecticut, so important? What's its legacy, especially for our listeners, you know, the law students out there?
Colombe is huge. It's a big deal because it really emphasized that the Constitution protects everyone, even the most vulnerable people in the criminal justice system. It's like a bridge between those earlier cases that focused on specific facts of a confession and the later, more standardized rules we see in Miranda.
Right, Miranda.
It basically says that courts are going to look closely at how a confession is obtained, especially when the suspect might have, you know, mental disabilities.
They're going to be extra careful.
Absolutely. There's that great closing thought from the case. The state must produce evidence through its own labor, not the defendant's coerced lips.
Man, that's powerful.
It is, right. It gets at the heart of our legal system, that the prosecution, they have to prove guilt through their own investigation, not by forcing a confession out of someone.
Right, right. Especially not by using, you know, shady tactics.
Exactly.
So for our listeners to really remember what we talked about today, what are the big takeaways from Colomb?
Okay, so first, you got to remember how important a suspect's mental state is. What's coercion for one person might not be coercion for another, especially if they have cognitive limitations. Second, the case shows us how messed up certain police tactics are, like using family, delaying arraignment, denying a lawyer.
Textbook bad cop stuff.
Right. And third, remember that Colum, it played a big part in how we understand the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights when it comes to confessions, even though it was decided under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause.
And that's a key distinction, right? This case happened before Miranda, so it's all about due process, not the Fifth Amendment's protection against self-incrimination.
Yeah, that's a really important point for law students to get.
For sure.
Colombe looks at voluntariness through due process, but it really helps set the stage for the more specific rules we see in Miranda.
Okay, so to wrap up our deep dive into Colombe v. Connecticut, here's a final thought for everyone, especially those of you studying constitutional law. How should law enforcement balance the need to, you know, solve crimes with the constitutional rights of people, especially those who might not fully understand those rights?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, think about how Colombe is still relevant today when we talk about police interrogations and making sure confessions are legit, especially when you're dealing with vulnerable people. It raises some really deep questions about what the state should and shouldn't do when they're dealing with people who might be at a disadvantage when facing, you know, the power of law enforcement.
Absolutely makes you think.
It does. It really does. All right. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Thanks for having me.
See you next time.
See ya.